Wisconsin don't comment, which I believe I quote in my comment to the section, states that they didn't think it advisable to have a longer period of 5 days as a group, automatically have to postpone the filing of the petition and so on to determine their heirs, and they thought that it shouldn't be, have to be held in limbo for more than 5 days. Now, on the state bar's recommendation, as you know, Senator, we received dozens of comments from people around, and I'm the only written comment that I received on this. Gentlemen, why don't you put in the same provision on your wills as you do on the intestate succession, have a 5-day provision in your honor. And the answer to that seems to be that you can put it in the will situation, because we thought the person wanted that to be in the will right away. The bar's general reaction to this was, why don't you extend it rather than 5 days? Thank you very much. You proceed then. Section 27, persons of a half blood, is the same as we presently have in RS-111.040. They inherit the same as the paper of the whole class. Section 28 on illegitimate children has a little twist in it. In subsection 2, it provides that the parent or father of an illegitimate child shall be treated as though he were the father of the legitimate child if his paternity is established during the lifetime of the child. This is to keep a claimant as a father of an illegitimate child leaving a substantial estate who hasn't just recognized his relationship before, claiming it after the death of his child. As far as I know, this is not after any other pattern, and just because the committee thought it was a good idea.
Haven't you violated the rule regarding wills by allowing a father to claim a child in writing, signed by him without two witnesses? In other words, aren't you in effect allowing him, where he's not otherwise left a will, to get a child share and somebody by an unwitness, right?
We're not talking about the father's will. We're talking about two situations, one in which the father dies, survived by children, but intestately.
Yes,
the question is whether this child is his child, and he's entitled to take upon his intestate debt. And we have said that if he recognizes the existence of the relationship in writing during the lifetime of the child, the child may claim. The other situation is one in which the child dies, and the father is claiming as his heir. And in that situation, we say, not unless you have done one of these two things during the lifetime of the child.
Yes, but when you have done it, you have allowed the father to will his property to a person without two witnesses. Suppose I am on a mountaintop freezing to death, and I have a pen and a piece of paper and a mistress back in town, so the only has to be my child. I write down, Sally Jones is my child. I want to tell the world because I'm about to die. She gets half my estate, not my spouse.
I don't think that's a will.
Well,
that's proof of fact. This is not a testamentary act, this is a proof of fact. Proof of relationship. You don't ordinarily require that every evidence shall be by a writing subscribed by the testator in presence of two witnesses and so forth.
This
isn't
just evidence.
This is just evidence.
Oh.
This doesn't establish it. This is a condition.
Sally Jones proves herself to be an illegitimate child.
That's right.
Well, I think the result is if you allow a will without the witnesses, just the same as if I'm permitting on the automatic will, but it will.
I think the situation in which you affect what you're getting asked to is that you got back in town two of your own children and the illegitimate child.
Which side are you on? There is such a lawsuit anyway, although that's
why I think I'm not done.
You're
going to have a mistress and a beard. Go ahead. Section 29. This is an unusual situation, but you may have relatives married, and their issue may claim under two lines from a common ancestor.
Give us an example.
The testator's son and his granddaughter marry and have issue. And the son is one of three sons, and the granddaughter is the daughter of another son, who is now deceased, and she claims along with five other grandchildren. Now, obviously, it's better for her to take a 1/4 interest than it is to take a 1/6 of 1/4 or whatever it is, so she gets the bigger share that she's entitled to have under the two lines of the same. But she doesn't get another share in addition.
What happens if my adopted son married my natural daughter?
Are you in jail?
No.
I'm in jail.
And then they have children?
Yeah.
Well, there's that's discovered.
I just claimed through one ancestor. You may, in that case, they would claim through the same degree of relationship, and it wouldn't make any difference. Of course, they chose. They can't double up. Now, we get to part two, advancements. Sections 30, 31, and 32 substantially restate RS-111.110 to 170. The last sentence of section 30 is new.
That purpose of property advance shall be valued as of the time the heir came into possession or enjoyment of the property, or as the time of the death of the decedent, whichever occurs first. There is now no rule that determines as of what date you value an investment. This is perhaps an arbitrary determination, but at least it makes definite what has been indefinite.
How could death occur first unless it's a gift given in...
This is a contemplation of death? It could be a gift in which there is a future interest given.
I see, yeah.
Or the... Yeah, future interest, yeah. So, whichever occurs first measures the value. That, I think, is a sensible provision. Subsection 2 of Section 31 is nothing but arithmetic. I think it sounds arithmetic. Section 32 conforms to the present law, 111.170. Am I going too fast or not? I think I have called attention to everything that's new. Section 33. Is the section to which Mr. Allison referred a few minutes ago, that for the purposes, for all purposes of intestate succession, an adopted child shall be treated as a natural child of his adopting parents. It is elaborated a little with the subparagraphs 1 and 2, which are exceptions to this general rule. If a natural parent remarries, and the child is adopted by the stepfather or stepmother, he continues to be the natural child of his natural parent and becomes the adopted child of the adopted parent. If a natural parent of a legitimate child dies, he treated as a child of the deceased natural parent for all purposes of intestate succession through the natural parent. I don't think there's anything very novel or significant about that. Section 35, I've already mentioned, this is the section in which the adoption of an adult will not qualify the adopted person to inherit as a member of a class unless the adopted person has lived with the adopting parent during his minority. Wisconsin code, I think this was taken from, cites a case in which a husband tried to qualify his wife as his adopted child so that she could take in a class gift. And I don't remember whether the case was cited for or against the decision, but anyway, it was decided in Wisconsin, and I think in Oregon that this is not a desirable result.
I can imagine the court saying that would have been illegal, so you couldn't make that.
You can adopt an adult person in Oregon.
But not your wife.
Your wife can't be your child. What makes you think so?
Because your wife can't be your child. That's it.
Well, I don't know whether she can or not, but at any rate, if she does, she doesn't become a member of a class to whom we're giving.
I've been thinking about 33 sub 1, and I'm wondering why it's here. If an adopted child is the same as a natural child, what's the purpose of preserving the natural relationship between the one parent when you have a stepfather-stepmother adoption situation?
So if the adopted child will continue to take through the natural parent because they...
Why should that be any different? I understand you said the reason, but why would it make any difference if an adopted child is the same as a natural child?
Well, a natural parent doesn't adopt a child.
Well, if you have a child, that's a better answer. If you have a child, and you consent to my adoption of that child, then this adopted child, of course, will be able to use your intestate cases to be able to inherit through me, but it also could through you as its natural parent. That's the law anyway.
That's the law now.
And this is just restating.
Well, no, I don't think so. Well,
what's the purpose of this section here? Won't some judge think that it is intended to signify a difference between an adopted child and a natural child?
Let me go back to the first part of this section. The adopted child shall be treated as a natural child of the adopting parent, and he shall cease to be treated as a child of his natural parent. Then we have to carve out an exception to that rule. Not in the case of Senator Turek was mentioning, where your natural child becomes his adopted child. Then your natural child is no longer claimed through you. But suppose that you marry the mother of this child. And we have said that the adopted child becomes a natural child, it shall be treated as a natural child of the adopting parents, and shall cease to be treated as a child of the natural parents. We don't mean that in the situation where you marry the mother of the child and adopt it.
But if there is no practical difference whatever, what's the purpose of the exception?
There is this difference. The exception says that he shall not be treated as a parent, as a child of his natural parents. Except, this exception has to be carved out if you're going to say he shall not be treated as a child of his natural parent.
You said he wasn't adopted.
No,
he has only one adopted parent, this adopted parent. That's a new parent. The non-natural parent is the only adopted parent he picks up. He's a natural parent, he gets a new adopted parent.
You're not quarreling with the result, are you?
Not at all. I'm saying that language is supposed to be perfectly superfluous and dangerous because it doesn't do anything for fear that somebody will try to make it do something.
I think it does do something. I don't really understand.
By any chance,
something
left out of subsection 1?
We're talking in subsection 1 about an exception to the general statement that the adopted child becomes the child of the adopted parents with the same incidence as his natural child, and he stops being the child of his natural parents. Now, we have to carve an exception out to the rule if he's going to stop being the child of his natural parents for purposes of inheritance. In the case where there is only one adopting parent, there he continues to be the child of his natural parents.
And that's what we're saying, except one. In the situation that I mentioned in the senior meeting, this exception wasn't in there. It was a child that did not inherit from the natural father taken.
Well, if that father adopted him, he would be the child of that father by adoption.
Yes, he would be my child by adoption. He would inherit from me. But if this exception wasn't in here, he could no longer inherit from you.
Correct.
That's only assumption. Wouldn't it be because
he doesn't inherit from Senator Fiddley anyway?
Pardon?
He does not inherit from Senator Fiddley when you adopt him. He inherits from
this is only with a stepfather and a stepmother.
Yeah. If you adopt Senator Fiddley's child, that child will inherit from you but not from him.
Yeah, I see. I think it doesn't concern the whole general code. Where you get to the natural parent merits, and then you go on and say, well, remarries, so you're not just talking about remarries. The natural parent hasn't married before, but this doesn't exclude the illegitimate children. It's not limited to illegitimate children. If there is an adoption. All right, we've got Senator Fiddley and his wife have a child. And Senator Turey and his wife love that child. And Fiddley dies. And Mrs. Fiddley marries a bachelor. Gordon McKay. And Gordon McKay then, with the consent of the Turey, adopts his child. Does this restore Mrs. Fiddley's rights as natural parent?
No, Section 34, right?
Can I ask you one question? What do these words mean, if a natural parent marries?
That's what I'm getting at. If a married or unmarried natural parent has a child,
right.
And either because the parent has an illegitimate child or because the father of the child dies, the child is left fatherless, the natural parent then marries or remarries. And the person to whom the natural parent is married adopts. The natural parent remains the natural parent of the child, the adopting parent becomes his adopting parent. This is an exception to the rule that upon adoption, the natural parent's relationship terminates. He shall cease to be treated as a child of his natural parents. Except.
So it does include.
It includes legitimate and illegitimate.
Yes.
Okay. Now, Section 34 relates to the effect of successive adoptions, which in some cases is simply that the successive adopting parents are treated as the natural parents, and the prior adopting parents' relationship is terminated for the purpose of succession. Somebody else to adopt it?
Yeah, the Duke's family? Well, their descendants are not going to adopt yet.
That's my answer for a long time.
Sorry. Duke and Tom.
It's a good idea to do it by will, right?
You can still do that.
Oh, yes. We've got some interesting provisions in here when it comes to the matter of predominant children, which makes substantial departures from our present law. Then we get to gifts in wills, deeds, and trusts to accord with the law of incestuous succession. This is picked from Wisconsin. Unless a contrary intent is indicated by the instrument, a gift by will, deed, or other instrument to an individual or member of a class described generically in relation to a particular person as a child, children, lawful issue, grandchildren, descendants, heirs of the body, next of kin, distributees, relatives, nieces, nephews, or the like, shall include any person who would be treated as so related for the purpose of incestuous succession. And then comes the exception for the adult who is adopted, to qualify as a member of the class. Except that for the purpose of instruction of an instrument, an adopted person must have been adopted as a minor, or after having been a member of the household of the adopting parent while a minor.
All right, wills. I want to ask whether the phrase or the alike, does that allow you, does that refer back to phrases such as heirs of the body and lawful issue or thus to relative nieces and nephews?
No, it refers back to all kinds of class gifts.
There's certainly other ways of saying the same thing.
That's using a generic provision. Now we get to wills. The first section 36, lowers the age of testamentary competency to 18 years. Any person who is 18 years old or older who has been lawfully married and who is of sound mind may make a will. This substantially conforms to our present law except as to the age of 18 and section 21. There is a good deal of reason to make this change because the gift to minors is becoming important for tax purposes and others. And a minor 18 years old ought to be able to say whom he wants to have his property and
have
it there.
Name on line 1 of page 15. That's described in the mid-range meeting.
Well, there's been some uncertainty about it, and this relieves the uncertainty. The provision for witness as a beneficiary conforms substantially to our present law, 114.310. A witness may take under the will only as much as he could take upon intestate death, unless there are enough other witnesses to make the will effective without his signature as a witness. We make quite a substantial change in Section 39. If I'm going too fast, please stop. Section 39. A will is lawfully executed if it is in writing, signed by or at the direction of the testator, and otherwise executed according to the law of 1, this day at the time of execution or at the time of death of the testator. That is not materially different from what we have. 2. The domicile of the testator at the time of execution or at the time of his death. 3. The place of execution at the time of execution. So, we will admit to probate in order any will which satisfies any of these requirements. Code is next. We can just send it. We also have an interesting addition to the present provisions under Section 40. We provide for pour-over wills. And Senator Faith Bailey will challenge this, I think. We provide that if you amend the trust agreement into which the testamentary estate is to be poured over, the trustee takes the proceeds of the testamentary estate upon the trust agreement as amended. You don't have to execute a new will after each amendment to the trust agreement. This amendment of the trust agreement is not subscribed by two witnesses, Senator.
It's violates the statute of wills also. It's intended here.
That's right. Everybody intended. That's right. Well, I consider this a simple way to accomplish the purpose of the testing.
Just to avoid that.
Well, it is. But I call your attention particularly to lines 8 and 9 on page 16.
Well, this is a provision which encourages banks. The other one I was talking about encouraged.
Now, we get down to revocation and alteration. 41 is simply introductory of the remaining section 42 to 45. Section 42 substantially conforms to our present law, section 114.110. And section 43 conforms to our present law, section 114.120. Revocation by marriage, section 44. Revocation by divorce or annulment, section 45, depart from our present law, section 114.130. Now let's take a good look at those because I think they're important. The will is revoked by the subsequent marriage of the testator if the testator is survived by his spouse. Note that as being a first condition to the question whether or not the will is revoked by subsequent marriage. Unless the will was drafted under circumstances, the will evidences an intent that it be not revoked by subsequent marriage, or was drafted under circumstances indicating that it was in contemplation of the marriage. 2. The testator and his spouse entered into an annuptial contract.
Is that written or
are you? Contract. I presume this language would include an oral contract. Do you think that's unadvisable?
I don't know. You're inviting a lot of problems.
I wouldn't quarrel with an amendment.
Yeah.
Pardon? I would not quarrel with an amendment in that particular.
Was that matter discussed by your committee work on this?
I don't remember the discussion of that.
They may have been relying on some other rules that I'm not familiar with having to do with that nuptial contract. Maybe there are rules about that, but I don't have to know. I think we should make a determination here as to whether or not that contract was being right, because you're going to invite all kinds of litigation.
Yeah.
Mr. Love, you wrote a book once.
It was old enough, Senator, from time to time.
I think I'll be right. I think that's what we're talking about. It may have been assumed that there would not be any nuptial contract that was in force unless it was in writing.
Motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those no, motion is carried.
Mr.
Chairman, it's not a word in my file.
What do you suggest? We said,
Okay.
former spouse, and any provision therein naming the former spouse as executor. And the effect of the will is the same as though the former spouse did not survive the testator. This I commend for you as being a sensible provision, much more sensible than that the marriage completely revokes a will executed prior to the divorce, revokes a will executed prior to the divorce. You may want to change this word evidence into a different intent.
Why not shows? Evidence is, I think it's a little bit, certainly a better word than indicates. But does it carry a connotation with it that there is any evidence of a different intent, which means a different interpretation by two people?
Talking now about a construction of a will.
Mm-hmm.
And a will discloses an intent. Unless a will discloses a different intent, or evidence is a different intent, then these results follow.
My name's Fabio.
I have a question. We're very painfully going through the same thing that you've been going through. Automobile to my nephew, John. And the automobile is destroyed in a total collision. 2 days before they testate or death, or in an action in which they testate or death. The automobile is insured. Now who gets the insurance? Does it go to the residuary beneficiaries, or does it go to John? And we decided that it should go to John. Provided that there was a no more than a reasonable time lapse after the casualty they lost, then that would afford the testator a chance to make other testamentary provisions. We picked 6 months as a critical period. This is a home section. I don't think it would serve much purpose with a review of that length, but I paused while you look at it.
It's a real, I think it fills a real gap in our criminal, sedation statute.
One particular monastery must have had poor communications because one brother wasn't found in his cell until he'd been dead for 3 days. The brother writing the log of the day's activities reported finding him. He said, "And there lay Brother Sebastian, black, stinking, and intestate." The code provides that in case a married person with children dies intestate, half the property goes to the surviving spouse and half to the children. It is our opinion that an overwhelming majority of persons in this circumstance would prefer that all of the property go first to the surviving spouse. We have talked to many other lawyers in our own area, and without exception, they are of the same opinion. To obtain a statewide cross-section of opinion, we wrote to all members of the bar named Smith. We asked whether they thought most people would prefer that all of the property go to the surviving spouse, or only half, or some other portion. Of the 8 lawyers who expressed opinions, all felt that most people would prefer that all property go to the surviving spouse. Asked what percentage of people would prefer this course, one Smith said 70%, one said 75-80%, two said 90%, and one said 100%. Two said most, and one said a great majority, without specifying percentages. We examined a large number of wills in the clerk's file and found that by the terms of these wills, without significant exception, a married person's property went first to the spouse and then to the children. We talked to the probate clerk. She says that from reading a great number of wills, it is her opinion that all married people prefer this disposition. Of course, it can be argued that wills are not a true criterion. Only people who wish to change the statutory course of intestate succession make wills, and people who die intestate favor the statutory disposition. However, this theory is not borne out by experience with real estate, bank accounts, and motor vehicles. Specialists in these fields to whom we talked are uniform in their opinions. A great majority of married people prefer that all of their property go to the surviving spouse. Put in percentages, estimates of the size of this majority range from a low of 85% to a high of 99.9%. Another reason for having all property pass to the spouse is the nuisance caused when minor children inherit tag ends of property which escaped the decedent's attention. A few $100 in a separate bank account, a few savings bonds he bought before he was married and forgot he owned, a lot or two he inherited. When fractional interests in these odds and ends descend to minors, the relative expense of handling them is staggered. It would save untold headaches and expense if the full interest passed to the spouse. It is true that if all property of an intestate goes to the surviving spouse, some heartrending injustices will result. One can well imagine a situation in which devoted children have honored and cared for their father for 40 years after their mother's death, only to have him marry a floozy and die the next day, indifferent, inconsiderate, and intestate. On the other hand, equally heartrending injustices will result under the proposed code. One can imagine a situation in which a father is abandoned by his children after a divorce. He remarries but neglects to make a will. Upon his death 40 years later, his children, complete strangers, claim half the estate which the widow helped create and desperately needs. It is apparent that the law of intestate succession cannot please everybody, and that there will be injustices under any plan. Some people must make wills to fulfill their wishes. We believe that the burden of making wills, and the penalty for failing to do so, should fall on those in the 10-15% minority, rather than those in the 85-90% majority. It would appear that we differ with the bar committee only in the conclusion which we reach. We agree with the committee's basic premise. At pages 17 to 20 of the proposed code, the committee makes these comments. The law should attempt to approximate as closely as possible the desires of the average intestate. The surviving spouse is the person closest to the decedent and most likely to be dependent upon his estate for continued financial security. Particularly where the estate is small, it is desirable to increase the share of the surviving spouse. Those are the comments of the committee. From this premise, the bar committee concludes that only half the intestate's property should go to the surviving spouse. We conclude from the same premise that the surviving spouse should have it all. Our second proposition is that in many instances, probate is unnecessary. For all practical purposes, a decedent's property passes at death to beneficiaries, subject to claims of creditors and death taxes. Thus, the basic purpose of probate must be to identify the beneficiaries and pay the obligations. It would seem to follow that if there are no complicating factors, if the identity of the beneficiaries is fixed, and if the debts and taxes, if any, are paid, there should be no need for probate. Of course, in many instances, there are complicating factors, and the proposed code deals with them admirably. It is difficult to imagine a problem which this code leaves unsolved. If there is a reason to believe that a man who has been missing for more than a year is dead, 10 sections of the proposed code provide a solution to the problem. If two people die simultaneously, 8 sections provide answers to the questions which will arise. If a man stands to benefit from a death which he has feloniously caused, 11 sections cover every phase of the problem. We would be the first to concede that the proposed code solves all the problems. But what if there are no problems to solve? What if a widow dies of natural causes, owning a home, a car, a bank account, and a few odds and ends, with no debts except current household bills, and is survived by 3 grown children, all legitimate? What if the children pay the bills and death taxes and agree that the property is to be divided equally among them? These people don't need a probate code with 291 sections. They need some simple method of proving that all debts and taxes have been paid and that they now each own an undivided 1/3 interest in the property. We suggest that to identify and satisfy creditors without a probate, the county clerk should publish the notice to creditors. Claims, if any, would be filed directly with the clerk. When time for filing claims expired and upon proper showing, the clerk would issue a certificate stating that the decedent's property was free of creditors' claims. Unpaid claims would be liens on the decedent's property, with appropriate exemptions for dependents. taxing authorities would deal directly with heirs and legatees, as they do now in non-probated estates, and would file a certificate with the clerk when taxes were paid or when it was established that no taxes were paid. If the testator had not asked for a probate, his will simply would be filed with the clerk, authenticated by affidavit. In case of intestacy, an affidavit would establish the identity of the heirs. In either event, the beneficiaries would decide among themselves how the property was to be divided. Probate proceedings would be instituted only if required by the terms of the will, or if requested by an interested party. Probate would then proceed as provided in the proposed code, with minor exceptions. In summary, we recommend that the proposed code be adopted with three modifications. 1. When a married person dies intestate, all of his property goes to his spouse. 2. The county clerk should publish the notice to creditors, and claims should be filed directly with the clerk. 3. Provision should be made for identifying beneficiaries and ascertaining and paying debts and taxes without a probate when probate is unnecessary.
Thanks for any questions. Mr. Carlson, I imagine that each attorney's experience differs from that of another. Now, it will assume, well, I've been practicing law for more than 30 years. And I say very, very conservatively, I've just been making some computations, that I have prepared a minimum of 3,000 wills. That's a lot. And this is one area, and I imagine the largest portion of my practice. But it amazes me to hear you say that you honestly feel that a majority of the people would want the wife, surviving spouse, to succeed to all of the property. Now, many, many of the wills which I have prepared have been for those people of an origin outside of the United States prior to their arrival here, first or second generation. And I would say that the vast majority of those people whom I know, this is my experience, that they would feel that they certainly want their children to participate in that estate. And one of the things that you hear the old timers say is, why are you working? I'm working for my kids. I want my kids to have it. That's been my experience. And I would say that it is relatively the minority group that would actually want their surviving spouse to succeed to all the property without any interest in that property going to the children. That's my experience. I'm just voicing what my experience is. The only question I have to ask is, did you appear before the Law Improvement Committee or any of the state bar committees in connection with this proposal of yours?
No, we didn't, and here is the reason. We had heard for years, of course, that there was such a committee. We kept hearing that one time soon their proposals would be submitted to the bar. In October of 1968, we received a bulletin. In the bulletin, it set out a schedule of hearings on the proposed Oregon Probate Code, a list of times and places for meetings in about 15 counties. There were two blanks. One was Douglas County, and one was Clark, Roseburg is located, and one was Washington County. The bulletin said, the list below is as complete as possible at the time the bulletin went to press. Where details of times or places are missing, members of the bar will be properly notified. We assume from that since time and place was missing for Roseburg, we would be notified at the time and place when the hearing would be in our area. The next thing we knew, this blue book came to the mail, and it was obvious at that point that there was no purpose to be served at the hearing before any bar committee.
Well, Mr. Carlson, aside from that, I find it rather strange that if the view that you espouse were so prevalent and so widespread that the committee that has worked on this for years would not have found its emergence or its appearance in other places in the estate, in the state of Oregon. And frankly, when I learned that you and Mr. Garrison were going to appear with respect to this, was the very, very first time that I ever heard this theory announced. Now, it would seem to me that if this was so prevalent as you seem to indicate, certainly they would have encountered it elsewhere, someplace. Now, perhaps somebody will speak to that.
Well, now, of course, I'm guided primarily by local experience. Well, first by my own, of course, and second by the lawyers in Roseburg. Coming up this evening, Mr. Garrison mentioned that he had a particular method of preparing wills by number and by letter, and the section on disposition, whether it's a wife or children, has then become so worn out he has had to replace it in his form book if he uses it so regularly. And neither he nor I were able to actually think of any instances, I was unable to think of any, in which the property had gone, property of the children, property of the spouse, other than token gifts. It's so regular in Roseburg, in my practice, that the property goes first to the spouse and then to the children. And he said it was practically without exception in his practice also. I talked to several other lawyers there, and that was their experience. Now, I had no way of getting a cross-section of the opinion of the state of Oregon, except the rather amusing method of writing to the Smiths, which has become a sort of accepted code method. Actually, the Smiths, without exception, said that in their experience, most of the people wanted the property to go first to the spouse. It ranged all the way from 70% to 100%. The average was a little over 85%.
Which is contrary to my experience. Senator Carlson, I don't
understand how it happened that we couldn't get any response out of the bar in Roseburg. Now, did none know the president of your bar during the past year?
No. Well, no.
I'm sure.
Is he?
He was right.
Now,
both Mr. Reynolds Barger and I tried to have you set up a meeting in Douglas County, whereby three or four of us would go down there and go over this code with the members of your bar.
Thank you.
where the wife now is the stepmother of the children. You don't want
the... She gets it all. Now, this is a possibility for an injustice, as I mentioned. But on the other side of the coin, there is a just as great a chance for an injustice the other way. And if 85% of the people really do want to go first to the spouse and then to the children, it's obvious that somebody has to make a will. We think it should be the 15%, not the 85%.
Section 54. Don't make it to the next.
This is a brand new and important section on the treatment of children. And it approaches it from a very different position than we now have under our present law. Under the present law, if a child is not named or provided for in the will, he takes that upon his estate death. Under this draft of code, the pre-admitted child takes a share which depends upon what the testator has provided for his other living children. If the testator has made no provision for his other living children, the pre-admitted child takes nothing. If the testator has made provision for his other living children, the pre-admitted child takes a share of the estate given to the other children.
Each will deposit it in his office for safekeeping, pursuant
Well, does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yeah. The press law permits the deposit in the office of the county clerk that may refer to that section 114.410. But we have a lot of wills that have already been deposited, and this section is to dispose of them by probate. That those that have already been deposited shall be held or surrendered as may be required until January 1, 2010, at which point it's all over.
Supposing a person dies on December 1, 2009, yes, and the will is surrendered to the county clerk. Now, if he is unable to deliver that will before January 1, 2010, and he destroy it, he's only had it for 20 days.
No, this is a will that was delivered by the testator during his lifetime. It can't be delivered after July 1, 1960, 1970, and this will go into effect.
The provision says it relates only to the wills delivered by the testator to the county clerk.
Yes.
There won't be any way to deliver them unless the deputy takes action. That's 14.14 will be considered repeated.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a comment on this? In our comments, I referred to quite a lot of correspondence. We made checks not only in Multnomah County to Jeff Dixon's staff, but a number of other counties, and the county clerks stated that this had been a great headache to them, and they wanted to be relieved of this responsibility of having hundreds of these wills in their possession. They didn't know what to do with.
After July 1st, 1970, there will be no more wills deposited with the county clerk by Sunday. And so we don't have any real problem about January 1st, 2010.
I certainly don't have any problem.
That carries us through this part, unless there are questions. If I go on into section 58 relating to the effect of homicide on intestate succession, wills, joint assets, life insurance, and beneficiary designation, this is somewhat broader than the present section. And in substance, all of these sections from section 58 to 68 explicit provide that the slayer cannot benefit by his felonious act. Now, I don't know whether you want to go into
that. That's fine. I just want to ask a question on 60 and 61. We relate some property which includes both real and personal under our definition. An undivided one half divided sovereignty, if I'm referring to personal property. An undivided one half shall remain the slayer for his lifetime, taking the bottom of it.